Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurink, and Samantha Shriver. A little later, we're going to be speaking with Matt DiPerno from his office in Portage, where we talk about the upcoming Republican endorsement convention, a first-time endorsement convention. He is looking to run for attorney general, and he just got back from Mar-a-Lago, where he visited with Donald Trump. And John, also in Mar-a-Lago last week, was Steve Cara, who is running for Congress in now the 4th Congressional District. He was able to hop on stage with Perry Johnson and Ryan Kelly and this Bitterman guy who's running the 11th Congressional District and this Ralph Rebrandt guy. And he gets back from Michigan, or he gets back to Michigan, John. And what do you know? Donald Trump has now given his full and complete endorsement to another candidate in that race. If you're Steve Carr, you got to feel a little jobbed here.
You got to feel a little jolted. What happened there? I mean, you think that just the fact that he was in a different district originally, the Trump organization didn't realize it, or what? Takes the fangs out of his campaign a little bit if Heising has got the same endorsement, especially in that conservative district, right?
Yeah, especially when the verbiage is exactly the same. Bill Heising has my complete and total support from the newly drawn 4th Congressional District, and then Steve Cara had the same exact, basically, endorsement verbiage when he was endorsed back in September. So, in short, this is what happened, John. So back when it looked like that Steve Cara was going to be facing Fred Upton in that district, and there were many people who were trying to get that endorsement, there were many people who were looking at running in that district against Fred Upton. And of course, Donald Trump does not want Fred Upton back in Congress after he voted for impeachment along with Peter Meyer and 8 other members of Congress. So he wants Fred Upton gone for having voted to impeach him. So Steve Cara at the time looked like the most viable option. He had raised the most amount of money. He had gotten the most amount of support. They were trying to clear the field so it would just be Steve Cara versus Fred Upton. And then what do you know? The redistricting commission comes in, redraws the district, ropes in Bill Heisinger and Fred Upton into the same district, which nobody really expected would ever happen. And now Steve Cara is not even drawn in that district. He's running against, his district is actually now in Three Rivers against Tim Walberg, but he doesn't want to run against Tim Walberg because Tim Walberg is, you know, fine with Trump and, you know, has strong roots in the grassroots. There's no reason to challenge Tim Walberg. So now he's got to face Upton again with Heisinger in a district he doesn't live in, because he lives in Three Rivers, but he can run in this 4th district. And now he's splitting up the pro-Trump vote between himself and Heisinger.
Exactly. Well, and it points out the risks, I think, that the Trump organization has. That's a small organization, from what I understand. And they're trying to play the endorsement game all the way down to the state representative level. If you don't have the people that really understand the situation on the ground, like in this case, you're gonna make some missteps, and this is, I think, an example of the risks of trying to play all the way down the line from a small operation at the national level.
What's your thoughts on this, Sam?
So I'm going to personally blame disconnection from the redistricting commission, because you think about it, when that initial bold rush of Trump endorsements came in, that was majorly during November, early December, and as we see with Steve Cara, September. Now, the redistricting commission was still heavily debating what these final districts would look like that they would approve. And even now, there still is some chances for alteration with the Supreme Court hearings. At the end of the day, they're probably not going to change significantly from where we're at. But I mean, there's people, voters in Michigan, who voted for the redistricting commission that didn't still continue to not really know what it is. It makes me wonder how many people in the Trump office were specifically watching the redistricting commission and what were their final takeaways and how much they fully understand went down in those final months. And I think we're kind of looking around at some of these Trump candidates. Let's take Melissa Carone, for example. And I can't tell you what her fundraising numbers were. I know that her last round of fundraising numbers weren't that hot. And I think there's been three different districts she's filed to run in and still kind of hopping around trying to figure out where she wants to be in a conservative MAGA district.
You know, you mentioned Melissa Crone. What's interesting here is we don't really know what her fundraising numbers are because she hasn't reported them from her last cycle, which is a problem in and of itself. She's having some problems there. But this is something that I touched on with Matt DiPerno, is the fissures within kind of the MAGA Trump group, and that the personalities that have developed here. Melissa Crone has yet to get the Trump endorsement. So he's endorsed, I think, about 10 folks or so for state representative, and Melissa Crone is not one of them, even though she was up on the forefront here, John. And what I'm seeing develop here is that there's so many different layers of conservative conspiratorial theories, and sometimes one group doesn't necessarily want to engage with the other group. They're pretty much saying, you know what, that's just a little too kooky even for me.
And I think there's a lot of Trump. Oh, I apologize, John, but I think there's a lot of Trump-endorsed candidates that are now proving themselves to be unviable candidates. They're not raising money. They're, you know, going about saying conspiracy theories that even extend past what we were seeing in December 2020. And I think overall, it makes me kind of question if over in the Trump world, there's kind of this this concern if it's time to take a little bit of a backseat and see what the next few months of spring brings.
Well, and Kyle, you know, if you remember the Tea Party phenomenon, this is starting to feel a lot like the Tea Party phenomenon when it started fracturing and started dissipating, and then eventually was kind of warped or absorbed into the Republican Party as a whole. Personalities dominate, factions dominate, the whole thing becomes fractured to the point where it has little to no effect in total. I wonder if that's where we're going to be in a year. Depending on what happens with Donald Trump himself, I could actually see this fizzling out before even the next presidential election. I mean, I could be wrong. He could wind up being very strong and still be able to command the interest he does. But it just feels like right now where it's starting to crack.
Yeah, it really kind of, it looks like the flashpoint has to do with, do you believe that widespread voter fraud robbed Donald Trump of the election? And that's where it really begins. And if you believe that, then why do you believe that? And how do you believe that? How do you believe that happened? And that's where I think these candidates who are looking to be credible, looking to be mainstream candidates for the 2022 election, are starting to take a hard look at this. And I'm going to mention Christine Caramo here in a second. And they're going to say, you know what? I mean, we can't really point to something without looking completely kooky. And we've got to back away from that. Because you're going to start, in order to try and go down that road, you got to do basically snowstorm somebody into all this technical language about computers and servers and chain of custody and a bunch of stuff that the regular person has no idea what you're talking about. And you don't know if you necessarily know what you're talking about either. If you start talking about, well, then, you know, this server got attacked with this server and somebody went in with this and we've got this central person who's out of state or maybe they're out of country. It's like these credible candidates, and I'm going to mention Christina Caramo here. She issued a statement and it's titled On 2020 Election Issues. This was issued today. It's 7 o'clock on Monday. This was issued. And she's talking about the Auditor General's performance report on the November 2020 election. And nowhere in this does she talk about widespread voting fraud contributing to Trump's loss. And in fact, she hasn't talked about that issue in months. And if you listen to the conversation with Matt DiPerno after this, he doesn't mention it one time either. He talks about changes that need to be made to the system and how we found through this last process how someone could hack into the system. But even he is now backing away from making a direct charge that somebody did. And it's a different, it's completely different language, John.
It's so difficult to make the argument. I mean, you had the Senate come out with its report saying there was no evidence of anything there. I mean, you can debate the point about whether Jocelyn Benson should have sent out all those invitations for absentee ballot. That's a debatable point. But other than that, I mean, nationally, you'd have to find issue with 65 different court cases. I mean, there's so many statements of fact that just kind of countervail that whole thing. That I think people are getting tired of it. I mean, come on.
I think it brings your point to full circle about the different tiers of this Trump group. But, you know, you have the individuals that are going into the technical language, like look at the computers, look at the software, etc. And then you also have the individuals that will go as far to say, like, there was sketchy things happening at the poll sites. People were typing in numbers that were inaccurate of how people were voting. And, you know, then you have, you know, Ryan Kelly saying, like, if you see something bizarre at the polls, unplug the machines right away. I mean, to go back to the infamous Melissa Carone quote to Representative Johnson, what did you guys do? Did you do something crazy with them?
Yeah. No, I think you're exactly right there, Samantha. So anyway, as we're looking going forward into this nominating convention or this endorsement convention that's happening next month, I think we're going to see a lot of different verbiage coming out as these candidates look to try and pivot toward being more of a mainstream candidate. Because look, they can get a lot of Republican support by saying we can't have no reason absentee ballot applications mailed out en masse to everyone. You can get a lot of Republicans to support that. You get everyone to rally around you. Just take a look at their ballot proposal that they're sending out and trying to collect signatures on. As a Republican, John, that's all really you have to do. Just say, yeah, I agree with all of these things, and we got to have tighter chain of custody, and we got to know that folks are keeping an eagle eye on the absentee ballot application process and the counting of ballots. We got to have inspectors. We got to have challengers. We got to have them available. They got to be watching everything. We got to have cameras in front of these drop boxes. There's got to be strict regulations on
better
the drop
training,
boxes.
Better training programs, stricter curriculum.
I mean, if you're a Republican, I mean, you can say this all day and everybody would be giving you the salute.
Every piece of an election machine needs to be made in the United States. Yeah.
The big issue, and that one of the things we're going to have to talk about coming up is, you know, there was a national survey that's found 25% of the poll workers across the country are going to drop out of, they're going to stop working for the next presidential election because a lot of this, the fatigue over the whole assertion that the election was stolen.
I definitely would not want to be a poll worker in this upcoming election. I mean, being a journalist is stressful enough, but
I know. And you can call for all these enhanced regulations and all this, you know, extra stuff. But if you don't have poll workers, reliable, honest people to volunteer to run the polls, you got a whole nother problem. So,
all right, let's do one more prediction here before we tune into our interview here with Matt DiPerno. John, do you think that we're going, what do you think the governor is going to do with this gas tax pause and this income tax reduction bills?
I think she vetoes the income tax thing. I think that generates some long-term structural issues that she can't really dig your way out of. I wonder if she shouldn't think about signing a temporary suspension of the gas tax for political reasons, and, you know, make sure that it expires or sunsets sometime after the election. Obviously it costs money from the infrastructure standpoint, but politically I think it would be a winner for her, but we'll see.
So I think, okay. I talked to different environmental policy experts for a story that I had published on Friday, and one individual from the University of Michigan, he had essentially told me that if the state was going to do some sort of gas tax suspension or gas tax vacation, that now would be probably the best time to do it. We have a lot of federal infrastructure dollars. We have the general fund surplus. We do have the means to kind of fill up that backfill. However, you know, what kind of damages will will be done to our infrastructure during that tax break. The governor's office, and I think those who are against this gas tax break, they're going to say, well, we don't need that. That's not going to be significant support. What we need is an EIT, so the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit. Now, Senator Schmidt over in the Senate, he has a bill that from year to year would restore it up to 30%, which is 10% higher than the original restoration in comparison to the federal EITC. So I think that an EITC is something that could get bipartisan support and be negotiable. However, there are some Republicans that make similar claims that it's just not enough relief that the people need and deserve at this point.
Right. And I think a lot of voters don't understand what the EITC is. And it's sort of an esoteric discussion point. The gas tax, though, is broad based. It's going to impact everybody. And she's already called for a suspension of the federal gas tax. So she's got that dichotomy out there. She can't say, well, the states shouldn't be suspended, but the federals should. I think she looks duplicitous if she does that. I think she's better off just signing the bill and saying, you know, this is a time for us all to come together, make gas affordable for Michigan families, and remove that issue off the table.
Especially since she's already written on to Congress to suspend the federal gas tax. Right. I think she is at a point at risk of seeming very hypocritical if she wants to suspend the federal gas tax, but not the one here.
Well, the problem is, though, is that she already told the Democrats over in the House to not vote for the gas tax pause. So then if she goes ahead and signs it, you'd have to feel kind of burned if you were a House Democrat and you went ahead and voted against it. Now, I know that there were some House Democrats who voted yes on that for political purposes, running for the Senate, or they're running in a competitive House district this coming 2022. But she
could signal out of the Senate before they actually pass it that I want something changed, so it's got to force it to go back to the House.
Oh, that's
awesome. Tell your House Democrats to go ahead and vote for it. You know, make a modest change to it. Maybe a date change. Maybe, you know what I mean?
Make it a 3-month change.
Yeah, she'd have to do it. She'd have to do it. I still don't know why you do 3 months. Why you wouldn't just take it all the way past the election? I mean, why do you want to be debating this right before the election?
But you know what? Gas prices could go down. I mean, they're so fickle. I mean, you really don't know. They could go up. They could go down. They could stay the same. I mean, you really don't know what's going to happen with them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of a lot of people want to connect Line 5 with this battle cry for energy independence. And we're still waiting to see if that Line 5 case is going to be handled on the state level or the federal level. I do wonder if the crisis going on in Ukraine and the gas prices are going to be concluded by the time that that case even is moved or decided on.
Yeah, you do got to wonder what's going to happen first here. So this is my prediction, John. I do think that she's going to veto it. I think the Senate and the House are both going to tie a bow on that gas tax pause later this week. And then I think we're going to have to look at our press email box at about, 6, 7 o'clock on Friday. And maybe we get veto letters on both. That's my prediction, that we get them at the same time. Gas tax veto and income tax veto on the same time on a Friday night or afternoon. Yeah.
I think the most important takeaway here, now that the fossil fuel debate has kind of shifted a bit because of everything going on in the world and with inflation, et cetera, is that, you know, we're not going to be able to boost up our energy supply overnight. It's not like we can click a switch and all of a sudden we have a golden abundance of oil. Mm-hmm. In the same way that we can't click a switch and everyone's going to be driving an electric vehicle. So I think patience is the most important tool here. Unfortunately, because of course that is a very bitter reality.
No. Yeah, we don't have a lot of patience sometimes, do we? We want change. We want it now.
Exactly. Or we look at the federal oil reserve. And the federal oil reserve, it's essentially designed more to provide assistance in the short term. And then I know that the United States has agreed to release $30 million out of the federal oil reserve. And that already makes up 5% of what is in it. Mm-hmm. Even that like really isn't enough to just bring gas prices back down to below $4.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, well, we're going to have to wrap this up here. We're going to bring in our next guest. I was able to talk with Matt DiPerno in his office in Portage. Let's go ahead and move on to that interview.
Will your lawyer talk to God and plead your case up on high?
We're joined now by Republican Attorney General candidate Matt DiPerno in his office here in Portage. Thank you for taking some time here and meeting with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Kyle.
Well, you were just in Mar-a-Lago this past week, meeting with Donald Trump, raising some money. What was the thing that struck you the most about going to meeting the president and being in Mar-a-Lago, kind of the belly of the beast, if you will?
Yeah, it was a great event. We had over 100 people at the event. It was a very good fundraising event for us. I think we exceeded all of our expectations. And did something a lot of people in Lansing in the establishment didn't think we could do. We've significantly narrowed the gap in fundraising in this attorney general race. We have all the money we need now for a state convention, and we're ready to go to convention and fight for this nomination. But what I think I took away most was Donald Trump believes in Michigan. He's all in for Michigan and for my candidacy. He knows we need to win the attorney general race here, but we need to have strong conservatives win these races. America first candidates who believe in his message. And so that's what we've been pushing for 8 months now.
Now, we understand he is going to be coming to Michigan. Will he be here before the endorsement convention on April 23?
I believe he will. I don't have a confirmation of a date yet, but that is the plan, that he'll be here before convention to talk specifically to the delegates.
So you've got – can you just kind of – let's go back in time a little bit to your announcement for running for attorney general. How did that come about? Was that encouraged? Was that something you've been considering for some time? Kind of lead us through how this came about.
Yeah, it was something I've been considering before we made the announcement in July. As you may know, even for the last 2 years, I've been around the state fighting against Whitmer's lockdown orders, fighting against mask mandates and vaccine mandates, fighting against critical race theory. So I've been giving speeches to groups across the state for 2 years now. Many people encouraged me to run for attorney general because we did build up a very big grassroots network over the last 2 years. So it was something I'd already been thinking about before we made the announcement in July.
Now, one of the things that you were out front on was advancing investigations into whether widespread voting fraud contributed to Donald Trump's loss in the 2020 election. Has it been difficult to try and convince people who believe that there was fraud that they now have to continue to involve themselves in the process of politics and in voting when they believe the last voting process was fraud? So you're relying on them to rely on this old process to fix a system that they believe was broken in the first place.
Well, first, the system is broken. I think we proved two things, I believe, in Antrim County. One, how corruptible our system is, how easy it is to hack, how easy it is to sort of infiltrate the security protocol and go directly to the database, if you want to do that. I think that's clearly established. That has to be fixed. And we also proved how fraud actually occurred in Antrim County, and we believe throughout the state. Now, we never got to an actual direct examination of the evidence in our case because the case was dismissed. We now have a hearing date of, I think it's April 12, with the Court of Appeals. So that's where that case stands. So because of all the work we did, you're right, there's many people, not just work I did, but other information people have put out. People believe, and I think rightly so, that our system is corruptible and needs to be fixed, and they don't have faith in the voting process. So I don't understand why everyone doesn't come together on this issue and make sure that we have a safe voting system and a safe voting process. The Democrats continue to fight Republicans on what seems to be very easy remedies for many of these problems. Voter ID, for instance, seems to be something we should all agree on, but the Democrats continue to fight on that issue. The Democrats continue to fight on the idea that we shouldn't have mass mailing of pre-filled out absentee ballot applications. That clearly violates the law. The Court of Claims said she violated the law. But they continue to push for those types of procedures. Republicans push back. So those are things that I think should be fixed. And because of those processes and failures, many people do believe that our voting system suffers and is not secure. I agree with that.
But so if they are to vote for you, let's presume that you win the nomination, you're on the ballot in 2022, what's to say that this whole system can't be corrupted in 2022?
Well, I think it certainly can be. The same thing could happen in 2022 that happened November 3rd, 2020. So what people need to do, we can't have this defeatist attitude that because there was voting fraud in November of 2020, that they shouldn't come out and vote in 2022. People have to come out and vote in mass numbers. Bring friends with you. No one should have the attitude of staying home. That doesn't help any of us. And Republicans have to get involved in the elections. They have to become poll challengers and poll workers across the state of Michigan. In too many Republican districts, we have Democrats that actually run the elections. And we have to change that. Republicans need to get involved. They need to run their own elections as poll watchers, need to get involved as poll challengers. We were significantly outnumbered at TCF Center on November 3rd. There were far too many Democrats compared to Republicans. Republicans just have to get out, and they have to get involved. And frankly, more Republican counties need to examine their own system and understand how it works. There was very little money spent across the state by Jocelyn Benson in training people. And so we have people across the state, clerks, precinct clerks, who really don't understand how the voting system works or how the voting process works. I believe every clerk should actually conduct some type of forensic examination into their own system. The only one I know who's willingly done that so far is Clerk Ferlini in Macomb County. He actually did a audit of his own system, and every clerk, I believe, should go out, follow his lead, and do what he did in order to examine their own system.
Let's turn the page here a minute. You had a debate in Alpena County with the other two Republican candidates for Attorney General, and during that debate, you said that you would charge Governor Whitmer, the Attorney General, and the Secretary of State on day one. How does that look? How do you do that on day one? Because the pushback was, well, where's the investigation? Where's the witnesses? How do you do that? How does that look?
Well, I think what we said was we do an investigation charge them. I'm not sure I said I'd charge them on day one.
Okay.
But we'd certainly start an investigation on day one.
Okay.
But what I'm looking at is misconduct in office. And at least for Governor Whitmer, this seems very clear. When she sent the elderly to retirement homes against medical advice, knowing that people would get sick or die, and she did it for political reasons, that alone fits clearly within the misconduct in office statute. It's 750.505. I'm very familiar with that statute. That's a felony, but there's also a corresponding misdemeanor charge that comes with a misconduct in office charge. And that's simply misfeasance, malfeasance, or nonfeasance in office. You're an elected representative, you're doing something within your duties in office, and you do something that taints the system or taints your office. So those are, that's, I think, very simple on its face. We know what she's done in terms of her scandals across the state, with the boating scandal, the airplane scandal. We've watched her sit in restaurants not wearing masks while demanding that people across the state wear masks, demanding that children wear masks, fining people for not wearing masks, fining people for keeping their businesses open during her lockdown, trying to take away their business's license. Her actions compared to her personal actions compared with that to what she ordered the people to do is clearly hypocrisy.
As far as the AG, what would you charge the AG with?
Well, let's first talk about Jocelyn Benson.
Okay, we'll go to Benson next.
We know what she did with the election. She sent out 7.7 million pre-filled out absentee ballot applications, which violated the Administrative Claims Act. We know that now. She told clerks across the state to ignore signature verification requirements. That's a huge problem. She allowed Zuckerberg to come into the state, bring in outside money in order to influence our elections. That violated the Equal Protection Clause in the state. So not only does she accept the money from Zuckerberg, she allows him to put his collection boxes in certain specific strategically controlled Democrat locations. But she also makes an agreement that she'll run the elections according to his directives. That's misconduct in office. Dana Nessel does everything in her power to protect the Democrat Party from scandal, and she uses her power like a sledgehammer against the opposition. We've seen her make threats against elected officials. On November 3rd, 2020, she did an interview with the Washington Post. She stated that any elected official who attempts to investigate the election will be investigated and possibly charged with criminal activity. That she, there's a top cop in our state threatening every lawmaker, every duly elected representative, that if they do their constitutional duty and investigate the election under the Ninth and Tenth Amendment, that she will charge them criminally. That's misconduct in office. You cannot use your power in office to simply attack your political opponents.
But some would argue that's what you would be doing if you were elected attorney general and you would be going after political opponents.
No, I'd be going after corruption. People who violate the Constitution and their oath of office and refuse to follow the rule of law. You know my story, Kyle. Have I ever been a guy who says, I'm only going to go after the other party? You know I've gone after Republicans, right?
You have.
Yeah, you have. I'm not that guy who just wants to attack Democrats. I want to change the way the political structure in Lansing works and operates. I'm tired of corruption on both sides of the aisle. I want to end it. In 2019, there was a study done that says Michigan is the most corrupt state in the union. Every branch, executive, legislative, and judicial, because of a lack of transparency. We're seeing that right now in Lansing with dark money that comes into these political campaigns through 501c4s or just straight up PACs. There is no accountability. And why haven't the Republicans, when they've had control over the state and House, or the House and the Senate, why haven't they passed legislation over the last several years that called for transparency? I think we're seeing that right now with the Chatfield scandal right now.
Do you think Tom Leonard has broken any campaign finance laws by the money that he's putting into his campaign?
Well, we know based on his last campaign finance report, we see seven campaign finance violations right on that last report.
Where he takes money from his candidate campaign, gives it to somebody, or his PAC, gives it to somebody else, somebody else's PAC, a former lawmaker's PAC, and then they give it back to his AG committee. That's what you're saying, right?
Right. There were the seven transactions that we identified specifically that violate MCL 169.271 in that exact transaction that you're describing, where his PAC gives money to a candidate, another candidate's campaign, and then that candidate's PAC gives money right back to his campaign. The whole point of that transaction or that structure is to circumvent the maximum campaign donation requirement or limits.
Now, but at your Trump event, though, your maximum donation was above the maximum donation threshold, right? You asked, your max was $25,000, and the max is like seven or something, right?
The max is $7,150 for people to contribute to a campaign. But they can also contribute money to a PAC.
Okay.
And other people could raise money for them. We weren't saying that people had to pay $25,000 themselves, but they had the option to get donations or raise money to meet that $25,000 threshold.
Okay. The other thing I want to ask you about, there does seem to be a split in the grassroots movement within the Republican Party. Folks who believe that we should do an audit, we shouldn't do an audit. There's folks, it seems to be personality splits. We should endorse DiPerno, we shouldn't endorse DiPerno. What do you think is going on within the grassroots?
Well, first, everyone should endorse DiPerno.
Okay. So if you're listening to this podcast, that's the message here. But why do you think these splits are coming, are starting to percolate?
You're saying specifically splits within the grassroots?
Yeah, and not necessarily just about you, but, you know, there seems to be conflicts between, let's say, Melissa Carone and John Rocha, and should we do this audit MI petition, or should we not? There does seem to be some fissures within this movement.
Yeah, and I don't know where that comes from, honestly. I mean, my position has always been that our election system is totally corrupted and we need to audit it and we need to fix it and change it. And no one has done more work than I have in that regard. My position has never changed. We need to do a full audit of the entire state election system. That includes paper ballots, that includes pre-election verifications, that includes looking at the actual paper, that includes auditing the qualified voter roll, removing people off that roll who should not be there, dead people, people who have gone away. So an audit encompasses the entire system. You cannot look at just machines and think you've solved the problem. You also have to look at the process, and you have to look at the paper. You have to do it in a very encompassing way, looking at all parts of our system. And I believe we need to get that done. We spend over $6 million per year auditing our schools, but we spend $0 per year auditing our elections. And our elections are considered an issue of national security. Why don't we spend any money auditing elections? We should, and we need to go back and audit the entire November 3rd, 2020 election. Not only machines, but our systems and the paper.
It sounds like then maybe folks are taking their eye off the ball if they're focusing on other things.
Well, there's other important issues, too, that we're dealing with in the state right now. You know, and no one should focus entirely on one issue. I mean, elections, securing our elections is an important issue because under our Constitution, we specifically say that our elections have to satisfy a purity standard. And as a constitutional republic, we elect representatives to go to Washington and to Lansing for us. If we no longer have faith that those people we send are duly elected, then we no longer have faith in the election franchise. And we have to fix that. But not only do we need to secure our elections, we need to eliminate these unconstitutional vaccine mandates. We have to eliminate mask mandates. We have to get rid of critical race theory. We have to solve the issue of line five, where the Democrats are trying to create an issue that didn't exist for environmental reasons. They're trying to artificially inflate the cost of energy to push people into green energy solutions. That is a bad idea. They're trying to terrify people along the west coast of Michigan, claiming that there's going to be some breach of the Line 5 tunnel that's going to send petroleum down along the west coast of Michigan and destroy their tourism industry. There's zero chance that's going to happen. The Democrats continuously want to end gun rights. We have to fight for the Second Amendment rights. I am 100% pro-life, and we have to fight for the lives of the unborn. And we have to close our southern borders, because keeping those borders open to illegal immigration continues to affect Michigan and causes a terrible sex trafficking problem in the state, which no one wants to talk about. But these are all issues we talk about every day that we have to eliminate. So it's not just elections.
There is one more issue that I want to get to. The Attorney General, Dana Nessel, did put out an ad just recently in which she mentions that you and the other Republican candidates would like to bring back laws against contraceptives and birth control mechanisms. I want to quick get your take on that ad. I know you saw it, and I want to get your reaction. Do you want to ban contraceptives?
No, no. Dana Nessel is playing silly little political games here. At the debate in Alpena County, and by the way, if you have not seen the debate, every one of you should go and watch that debate. It's on the Alpena County GOP Facebook page. I believe it. You can find it other places. You can find it on the DiPerno 4MI Facebook page. Go out and watch it, because you'll see the real distinction between a conservative candidate and a fighter like myself and my opponent, a real milquetoast progressive lobbyist. So go out and watch that debate. But on this particular question, someone asked the question of whether or not we thought the decision of Griswold versus Connecticut was correctly decided. Griswold versus Connecticut was a Supreme Court decision back in the 1950s where they stated that the state cannot prevent a married couple from purchasing and using contraceptives. The answer that everyone gave was that that is a state right issue. It's not a federal issue. Dana Nessel tried to spin that and claim that everyone was saying they're going to ban contraceptives. No one said it, and it's completely ridiculous that she would go out and try to spin it that way. Her goofy little ad that she just put out, where she really just did it as a two-day ad in one city and spent $2,000, trying to really trick the media into playing her game and pushing it out all across the place. And she spends $2,000 to get the media to basically publicize her ad across the entire state. But she needs to focus on the real issues. In 2018, Tom Leonard lost to her in part because he doesn't want to fight. He didn't want to debate her. He didn't want to challenge her on these types of ads. I will challenge her because it's a silly ad. It's misinformation. She knows that she's lying to the people. She knows nobody actually said what she's claiming. And she doesn't want to talk to about the real issues that I just described. She doesn't want to end sex trafficking in the state. She doesn't want to close the open borders. She doesn't want to end mask mandates or vaccine mandates. She wants to continue to corrupt our system, continue to cover up scandal in this state. We want to restore this state to a constitutional republic, and I'm ready to debate her any day, any time on any one of these issues. I will not hide from her. I'm ready to fight her head on in this election, and I will defeat her in November of 2022.
Matt Turno, Republican candidate for Attorney General, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Appreciate Matt DiPerno for talking to us a little earlier. Also, John and Samantha, also AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Mark Bayshore for putting this together for another week, trying to make this podcast sound a little better and help us with some of the technical stuff. I still can't get all of this technical stuff right, John. I've got the mixing board here and it still seems kind of hit and miss. Like sometimes everything's clicking on all cylinders and sometimes it just doesn't. I think it's the technology ghost.
Everyone wants to be a podcaster, but not everyone can be. And I would say that the MERS Monday podcast is doing a pretty good job.
Well, thank you, Samantha. I think we're doing fine. As soon as I get this this audio thing and we exercise the MERS technology ghost who's been messing with our heads for 20 years, John. Am I the only one who believes in it?
I do believe in the ghost of the MERS world headquarters.
I know there's some former MERS staffers who are listening to this who also believe because they've experienced mysterious, strange things happening around 5 o'clock with their computers and the server and the internet.
Or when the sun goes down, I'm always so fast to get out of here. When I like turn those lights off, I am knees to chest sprinting down the ramp.
The ghost is a friendly ghost, though. He just is mischievous. He just likes messing with our technology.
It's the mischievousness that gets me the most spooked.
All right, we better put an end to this before people think we're completely off our rocker.
Until next week, I'm Kyle Holman. Take care.